Lecture 23, Maya Decipherment.
In this 23rd lecture, we travel far from the eastern Mediterranean world and go back to lowland Mesoamerica, Central America, which we visited much earlier in this course. And when we, in our previous visit, talked about John Lloyd Stephens and Frederick Catherwood, who revealed the Maya civilization to an astonished world in the 1840s. The first part of this lecture traces highlights of Maya research in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, especially the efforts to record Maya glyphs. As you'll remember in some of the earlier lectures in this course, one of the problems of decipherment is having enough copies which are accurate to really be able to study the script. So, quite rightly, some of the early Mayanists realized that to record Maya glyphs must be a high priority. And we'll talk about a remarkable Englishman, Alfred Maudsley, and others who did this work. In the second part of the lecture, we'll describe the triumph of decipherment, which is very much a product of the 20th century, an event, or development rather, which unfolded over half a century from 1952 to today. This, like the decipherment of cuneiform, was a team effort, not the effort of one single person. And finally, in the last bit of this lecture, we'll look at some of the dramatic changes in our understanding of ancient Maya civilization which have resulted from decipherment. From the 1870s onwards, that's about a generation after Stephens and Catherwood revealed the Maya, Harvard University sponsored a series of expeditions to explore the Maya lowlands, looking for new cities, as well as excavating at already known sites, like the great city of Copan and the lesser center at Quirigua nearby. The German archaeologist Edward Seller combined archaeology with a study of Spanish chronicles. He realized that maybe there were some answers to the mysteries of the Maya script buried in documents written by early Spanish missionaries and settlers. He also studied, as part of this, the Maya stelae, that's the uprights upon which rulers commemorated their dates of accession and deaths and other achievements, as well as inscriptions on some of the monuments. Seller, who was a very patient worker, succeeded in working out some of the basic details of the Maya calendar. Notice at once we're getting into the issue of the calendar. We'll come back to this in a moment. In 1881, another major player arrived on the scene, Alfred Percival Maudsley, an Englishman of independent means, who visited Quirigua and was so taken with the inscriptions that he devoted the rest of his life to copying them. Maudsley was single-minded. He horrified his gentleman's personal gentleman, Think Jeeves, a la P.G. Woodhouse, by using his silver-backed hairbrushes to clean inscriptions. And for more than 10 years, he explored Maya ruins, mapping major sites, and recording as many glyphs as he could. One of the things he did was to make plaster casts of some of the major stelae, major carvings, and inscriptions, and, for the first time, produced a significant body of accurate copies for other people to use. Seller and Maudsley were among those who identified the Maya long count calendar. That was their long linear calendar, which reckoned time in 5 cycles. The longest of these cycles were the so-called baktun, of 144,000 days. This discovery enabled people to date many Maya stelae and inscriptions. But it didn't decipher the language. There's a difference between deciphering a script and simply figuring out a calendar. Because with a script, you are getting into statements about deeds and actions. You're dealing with personalities. You're dealing with events. With a calendar, you're dealing with a system that unfolds and repeats itself all the time. The Maya area is hot and low-lying and difficult to work in, owing to the very thick vegetation that mantles many of the monuments. And really the most successful strategy to any sort of Maya research, as people like Morley realized and Maudsley, was the notion that you went to the same place again and again over long periods of time. A series of remarkable archaeologists worked in the lowlands for long periods of time. One of them was Sylvanus Morley, an American, who worked intensively on the inscriptions. He was also one of the people who realized the importance of informing a broader audience about Maya civilization. He became the leading Maya popularizer of his day. One of the major players in early research on the Maya was the Carnegie Institution, which at that time supported archaeological research. And from 1914 onwards, it conducted excavations and in long-term investigations at many sites. Among the scholars who worked on the projects funded by the Carnegie were Sylvanus Morley, whom we all already mentioned, and Alfred Kidder. Morley was an interesting and very charming man. He studied Maya sites of all time periods, trying to get a sense of all the eras, all the different regional variations of the civilization. The problem was that he was not a very good copier, and a great deal of his work is not that accurate compared with that of his predecessor, Maudsley. He also hated being in the rainforest. He berated someone once who waxed lyrical about the romance of being in the rainforest by saying that anyone who likes being in the bush is crazy. He was a man who liked his comforts. He was also a very charming gentleman and became very obsessed with the Maya and the popularization of them, to the point where at the end of his career, his research was not really of much use. Another well-known figure who worked in the Maya area was an archaeologist of tremendous stature, an American called Alfred Kidder, who was responsible, among other things, for some of the first chronological studies of the Pueblo Indians of the Southwest. And for many years, he was in charge of the Carnegie program studying the Maya. One of the persistent themes in this course has been the emerging role of local archaeologists in the study of early civilizations. Of nowhere has this been more true than Mesoamerica, where Mexican archaeologists for many, many years have been actively involved in the study of the Maya. They worked heavily at Teotihuacan, up on the highlands, and they have been deeply involved in Maya sites. One of the most famous Maya discoveries was made by a Mexican archaeologist, Alberto Ruz, in 1952. Ruz was working at the city of Palenque, whose architecture is particularly distinguished. One of the most famous monuments there is a pyramid with a temple on it, which is called the Temple of the Inscriptions. And in 1952, Alberto Ruz was examining the temple when he noticed the paving stones on the floor in one place were slightly irregular. He took them up and discovered a passageway leading into the heart of the pyramid blocked with rubble. It took him 2 months to clear the staircase. 2 months of working in intensely hot, crowded conditions. But eventually, he came to a sealed burial chamber, right under the pyramid. And in the center of this burial chamber was a magnificent sarcophagus with a lid covered with intricate Maya glyphs. Maya glyphs, to the casual observer, are grotesque and complicated and intricate, which makes the decipherment of them much harder. He lifted the sarcophagus lid, and inside was the skeleton of a man, an elderly man, bedded with a magnificent jade mask and other lavish furniture. But a question remained. Who was this person? Who was the powerful lord who had apparently caused his burial place to be made underneath a vast pyramid with atop it a temple? A temple of architectural distinction. Who was he? Rus was unable to say. He was unable to decipher the glyphs on the sarcophagus lid, which would have told him the answer. From all this research emerged a vision of the Maya, formulated mainly by American scholars and also by an English Mayanist, J. Eric Thompson. And Morley, Sylvanus Morley, and Thompson shared a common vision of the Maya. They thought of them as peaceful people, headed by astronomer priests, who devoted much of their time to measuring the passage of the heavenly bodies and the passage of time. They were, in short, peaceful calendar priests, obsessed with the passage of time. As so often happens in academic life, when somebody produces a somewhat compelling theory, this vision of the Maya became literally academic dogma. It was the interpretation of the Maya which was effectively accepted by everybody and was so powerfully presented by Thompson and others, archaeologists with power in the academic world, that it was very difficult for any research to go in any other direction. It was certainly very difficult for anybody interested in the script to research in a direction or to publish anything in the direction which would suggest that the glyphs were not just calendar signs, that they were phonetic writing, that they were a script. And to a considerable degree, work on decipherment slowed. Meanwhile, from the archaeological point of view, things shifted a great deal. The focus up to the 1970s had mainly been on the study of large cities and the collection and copying of glyphs with what you might call the lords of the Maya. But then in the 1970s, as part of a general shift in archaeology everywhere, people began to look at the Maya in very different ways. They began to look at what you might call Maya settlement. How the Maya cultivated the soil. How did they live in their humbler settlements? What were their villages and hamlets like? What were the dwellings of commoners laid out like? And above all, what was the distribution of Maya communities over the landscape? Were there big centers and under them hierarchies of lesser settlements, towns, villages, and whatever? How did this fit with models of Maya agriculture and so on? How did Maya civilization feed itself? And there were tremendous advances in this field. For example, it was discovered that much Maya agriculture relied on swamp fields, which were linked with networks of canals, which enabled them to harvest crops much more frequently than they could on the tropical soils, the dry soils, which were only of moderate fertility and highly susceptible to erosion when cleared. So the research took a new direction. And it was very interesting that the first real advances in the study of the glyphs happened not in American or English scholarly literature, but in all things Russian. In 1952, a Soviet ethnologist, Yuri Knozorov, published an article in which he argued that the Maya glyphs were a phonetic script. This was a remarkable advance and was largely ignored by most people working on the script. Meanwhile, in the field, and Knozorov did not visit Maya country until, I believe, the 1990s. Meanwhile, the artist Tatiana Proskuryakov, who worked at Harvard, studied the stelae at a Maya city in Piedras Negras. Proskuryakov was a brilliant artist. She created a series of reconstructions of the Maya city of Copan, for example, which are not only very accurate, but are artistically absolutely superb, and they give the essence of the settlement and its surroundings in its heyday. But she also studied the stelae at another Maya city, a smaller center, called Piedras Negras. She spent months on these. She was a meticulous worker. And she noticed that the stelae had been erected in sets. They weren't just one stelae by itself. It was sets of them. And she realized that these commemorated the rulers, the reigns of successive rulers at Piedras Negras. In other words, the stelae weren't just calendars. They were historical documents recording dates of birth, accession, and death. They were archives, in a way. And they were written in some form of script. This, again, was an enormous advance. One of the reasons Proskuryakov was studying these stelae was that even as late as the 1960s, there was no large corpus of accurately recorded Maya inscriptions. There were numerous copies, but most of them, particularly Morley's work, were not particularly useful. They made many mistakes. This whole business of copying and decipherment requires an extraordinarily precise sort of mindset and a passion for detail, as we found with cuneiform, which many people, myself for one, do not have. It requires extraordinary patience, the persistence of a terrier, and brilliant analytical skills. But by the 1960s, when photography was much more precise and so on, the technology was there, steps were now being taken to collect an absolutely accurate body of copies as a basis for progress on decipherment. One of the big pastimes of academic life, and I must confess it's a pastime that I don't particularly enjoy much, is conferences. We constantly go to conferences at which one reads papers and discusses the progress of your research. Many of these papers are startling for their banality, and many of them, I suspect, and maybe this will make me unpopular with many academic colleagues, are written just for the sake of going to the conference. But occasionally, there are very, very useful and significant conferences, particularly when, in archaeology, when you get together a group of scholars who work very largely in isolation. For example, when you take the Maya, you're talking about people who were working in the rainforest in widely separated ruins. And in 1973, a roundtable conference at Palenque was called. This brought together archaeologists, epigraphers, and other scholars who really didn't know each other very well. And it brought together a very important group of three scholars, Floyd Lounsbury, Linda Sheely, and Peter Matthews, all experts on Maya script. And they literally, at that meeting, sat down, repeatedly used royal prefixes, verbs, and titles, and were able to reconstruct the life stories of no less than six Palenque rulers, all from a dynasty called the Shield Dynasty. This was a major advance. It was done by just dialoguing, literally with pieces of paper on tables and on the floor. At this point, they were hot on the scent of the script, and further research enabled them to name the anonymous Palenque ruler found by Antonio Ruz. His name was Pakal, the Lord Pakal, Pakal the Great, who ascended the throne of Palenque in AD 524 and reigned for 67 years. You've got a really tight identification and a date. The impetus of the Palenque meeting was followed up. A series of informal meetings at Dumbarton Oaks and elsewhere followed, at which the three scholars and a small group of colleagues started to look not at individual glyphs, but at entire inscriptions, just like Rawlinson did at Behistun, you'll remember. And for the first time, they began to translate as much as 90% of individual inscriptions. A tremendous advance. This is research as important as Nobel Prize-winning research. It unlocked an entire civilization. By the end of the 1970s, progress towards decipherment was inexorable and continues to accelerate to this day. And we're very lucky to have lived through a new era of research and, in a way, experienced at first hand what Egyptologists did after Champollion and what people working on Assyria did after the work of Rawlinson Hinks and others. Because, thanks to this decipherment, our knowledge of Maya civilization has been completely transformed. They were thought once of being peaceful astronomers. Now they emerge as competitive, bloodthirsty rulers, presiding over a maze of city-states, large and small, conducting diplomatic marriages, negotiating, forming alliances which form apart, and fighting one another for power, territory, and prestige. Maya history, as revealed by the glyphs, paints a far more complicated portrait than that of peaceful astronomer kings. It's a complicated portrait of dynastic histories, of a civilization dominated for many centuries by larger cities like Tikal, Huaxtun, Calakmul, Palenque, and Copan. Like, as one colleague of mine put it, a bag of ferrets tied at the top, struggling with each other. The only thing that unified them was a basic common culture and basically common religious beliefs. Like the Sumerians, it was a restless civilization of city-states. And as part of this, the Maya lords placed a great emphasis on establishing their legitimacy, their divine genealogies. For example, the lid of Pakal's tomb, the sarcophagus, records his genealogy and legitimizes his rule. Legitimacy was terribly important to Maya lords because they were the intermediaries with the royal and divine ancestors, and this was the crux of their power, their hold over the commoners whom they exploited. Decipherment has other fallout, too. It's transformed the excavation of Maya cities. For example, one of the most intricate archaeological jigsaws of Maya civilization is the major center, the Acropolis, at Copan. This combines the study of deciphered glyphs with tunnels dug right into the heart of the complex. They dug over 2 kilometers of tunnels right underneath it, because obviously you can't excavate to the center by digging from the top. As a result, using inscriptions, they've been able to date the earliest inscription at Copan to a precise date, December 11, A.D., 435. And they've also been able to identify the individual architectural achievements of the successive named lords of Copan for over 400 years. This is research which is real teamwork, and the essence of the discovery of ancient civilizations is teamwork. Most important of all, the decipherment of Maya glyphs has opened an unexpected window into the complex and flamboyant spiritual world of the ancient Maya. We now know that the Maya lords weren't only warlords and diplomats, they were powerful shamans who had the spiritual power to pass freely into the other world of ancestors and gods. And they did so in public. There was nothing they did not know about public display. Look at the center of Tikal. Look at the center of Copan. These are settings, the stage, as it were, for performance, for spectacular ceremonies. Imagine twilight, flaming torches, drumming and chanting, incense arising. And then suddenly, carefully lit, the entrance of the temple, atop of the pyramid, a figure in white appears. It is a Maya lord in triumph, in trance, having taken hallucinogens. He gashes his penis, and the blood flows onto a piece of bark or paper. As he gashes himself, the drums reach a climax in front of the crowd gathered, looking at him. He has passing into the world of the ancestors. The setting of the plazas and the pyramids, the artificial mountains, was a copy of the spiritual world which surrounded the Maya. It was a setting, and this was the setting with a theater where they validated their authority as religious and secular leaders in front of their people. Their power was their spirituality, and on this they depended for obtaining the cooperation and conformity of their people. In a way, one is reminded of the Queen's coronation in England or the inauguration of a United States president. There is ceremony which validates the office. Like Babylonian cuneiform, Maya glyphs were deciphered not by one person, but by a team of epigraphers working closely together at critical moments. The whole glyph business is a matter of constant emails and phone calls and conversation, of people knocking ideas against each other with no holds barred. There's a sort of trust between these people where nobody's judging how good someone is. They're all trying to produce decipherment. It's a marvelous thing to watch and very powerful. For example, one of the things they've now done is deciphered the Maya cosmos, and using computers they were able to reconstruct the sky at a particular date, particular year, so they can work on this relative to the calendar. So we're really beginning to understand Maya cosmology. The efforts of decipherment have revealed a spectacularly complex civilization, and it ranks this decipherment as one of the great scientific achievements of the 20th century. The point about all of this is that none of these societies were simple. They were very, very complex. And many of them in their spiritual lives, and I always get into trouble for saying this, rival in the complexity of their religious dogma and their teachings that of Christianity or Islam. For example, back in the 16th century, soon after the conquest of Mexico, a group of Franciscan friars arrived in the ruins of Tenochtitlan, having walked from the Gulf Coast barefooted, I may say, to show their poverty, and engaged in a dialogue with the Aztec priests who had survived the conquest. By all accounts, the debate was one where they agreed to disagree, but one gets a strong impression that the Aztec priests more than held their own. So never, never, and this is the lesson of Maya glyphs, underestimate the complexity of the spiritual aspects of ancient civilizations. And that, to me, is the greatest lesson of Maya decipherment. In Lecture 24, the last of this course, we'll summarize the main lessons we've learned and use three major discoveries to dramatize the transformation in the study of early civilizations from the days of the great adventurers till now. In a way, Maya decipherment encapsulates this, because you start with basically amateur archaeologists copying inscriptions highly informally, right down now to the disciplined, very free-for-all dialogue of people working on the decipherment of a language, one of the great triumphs of the discovery of ancient civilizations.